You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferrick.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll meet a Wisconsin man who's making history come alive in two of the state's scenic lighthouses.
First, Waukesha County is considered one of the most reliably Republican counties in America. But voters there tell reporters they're feeling frustrated by the options they have on the ballot for president this fall. Here are a few of those Waukesha County voters featured in a video produced by Bill Schultz.
You typically vote Democratic or Republican?
Republican.
And how do you feel about your choices in this election?
I'm sick to my stomach.
You know, there are days when I'm like, okay, maybe now he's on the right track, and then tomorrow comes, and I just put my head down and go, ugh, never mind.
It's a tough year. I'm struggling, and I told my wife today, I'm not. She asked me who I was voting for, and I said, I'll probably have to figure that out when I get there.
Heard there from three Waukesha County Republican voters in a video produced by Bill Schultz for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
Craig Gilbert joins us now for a look at the Republican base and its mixed feelings about Donald Trump. He's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Craig, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be with you.
So how much is riding on Waukesha County for Republicans come November?
Well, it's a county that the party relies on for big turnouts and big margins, partly to just offset the big Democratic margins out of Milwaukee and Madison. So, you know, some of these elections are to some extent about the swing vote and persuading undecided voters, but they're also about turning out your own side, and there's kind of a battle of the bases in Wisconsin between Madison and Milwaukee for the Democrats and places like Waukesha for the Republicans, which side turns out more and which side is more unified behind their candidate.
Which side does turn out more?
Well, it depends. In midterm elections, it's hard to top what you see in places like Waukesha, Ozaukee, and Washington counties. They tend to have a turnout advantage over Democrats because there are Democratic voters that only vote in presidential elections. But even at the presidential level, I mean, if you go back to 2012 and you look at, Republican vote per capita, which one way of calculating this is how many votes did Mitt Romney get for every eligible voter in that county? Well, nobody exceeded Waukesha County, nobody in the country. The combination of turnout and big Republican margins made it the highest performing county in the country. So that is a high bar. And so part of the challenge for Donald Trump is trying to replicate that.
And you spoke with people in Waukesha County about how they were feeling about the prospect of voting for Donald Trump. And what did they say?
A lot of frustration among Republican voters. Again, this is not your typical election cycle where you're used to seeing Republican voters in a place like Waukesha. Much more enthused, much more unified behind their candidate. I mean, there's some history here. Donald Trump did terribly in Waukesha in the Wisconsin presidential primary back in April, which is ironic because he was essentially, you have a Republican nominee who has been at his weakest in the most Republican parts of the state. He's made some progress with Republican voters in Wisconsin, as he has nationally, but there's still some lingering weakness, there's still some reluctance, and in a place like Waukesha where you have a lot of sort of conservative voters, serious voters, people who are engaged, who follow politics, there is both, a reaction against his style and rhetoric and temperament, but also some suspicions and skepticism about his politics and whether he's a serious conservative or not.
So if you had to elaborate that on that a little more, what would you say explicitly is holding people back from voting for Donald Trump, or maybe at least maybe they'll vote for him, but from supporting him wholeheartedly?
Yeah, so their dilemma is they obviously don't want to vote for Hillary Clinton in most cases. I mean, she's very unpopular among Republican voters. They are. Some of them will come around to Donald Trump, but if they're having a hard time, it's hard. I heard that over and over again. It's tough. It's difficult. You know, he's made it hard for them by some of the things he said. So their options are at this point, to vote for a third party candidate like Libertarian Gary Johnson, to hold their nose in some cases and vote for Donald Trump, or to skip the presidential ballot and just vote for the Republicans down ballot like Ron Johnson in the Senate race, or obviously to stay home. And again, Waukesha is not a place where very many people historically stay home, but given, kind of the numbers, and we see in the polling too, it's hard to believe that there won't be some deficit in Waukesha for Donald Trump, either in terms of the scale of the Republican turnout or in terms of the percentage of the vote that he pulls out of there. And that means he's got to do even better in the rest of the state to make up for that.
Is that likely to happen?
In some areas, he could do better. I mean, he's polling better in the Green Bay television market in northern Wisconsin than Mitt Romney did at this point in time. Hillary Clinton is particularly unpopular in parts of northern Wisconsin. But again, you know, it's still going to be hard to make up for any shortfall in the most Republican and the most populous part of the state. And, you know, as well as Mitt Romney did in southeastern Wisconsin 4 years ago, he still lost by 7 points statewide. So, you know, it's just Republicans in presidential years. Wisconsin is a state where you just have to maximize on all fronts. And it's going to be hard to overcome any softness in these Republican-based counties.
And, Craig, is the story you're telling here, is it just the story of voters feeling tepid about Trump in Waukesha County, or are there other counties elsewhere in the country that look a little bit like Waukesha County?
There are other counties that are, you know, they have some political and demographic similarities to Waukesha County. Waukesha County is kind of a high, you know, above average in education and income. It's overwhelmingly white. It's very conservative. It's suburban. You have counties outside of cities like Pittsburgh and Cincinnati and Indianapolis that resemble Waukesha County. There are some special factors in Waukesha County, but it's not an island unto itself. And we do know from national polling that Donald Trump has not consolidated Republican voters to the same degree that Hillary Clinton has consolidated Democratic voters. So he does have some shoring up to do in his Republican base. He's also got some weakness among college-educated voters. You find a lot of them in these high-turnout Republican counties. So it's not just Waukesha County. It's particularly striking in Waukesha County, particularly since we're used to just extraordinary levels of Republican unity in Wisconsin. And so that makes this race different from past races.
Craig, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Okay, it's great to be with you.
That was Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, joining us to talk about the struggle some Waukesha County Republicans are having with the presidential candidates on the ballot this fall. Our next guest brings two of Wisconsin's historical lighthouses to life by reenacting the daily lives of two lighthouse keepers at the Bailey's Harbor Range Lights and Eagle Bluff Lighthouse in Peninsula Park.
Ed Miller portrays those lighthouse keepers. He's also the chair of the Ridges Lighthouse Committee, which restored one of the lights at Bailey's Harbor and is currently raising funds to restore another light there. You can find pictures and info linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Ed, welcome to the show.
Oh, my pleasure.
Well, what, first of all, got you so interested in Wisconsin's lighthouses?
Well, we have the Bailey's Harbor Range Lights, where I'm a volunteer. And about 3 years ago, I was the coordinator for a complete restoration we did on the lower range lights. And what really got me going, I grew up in Milwaukee, close to Lake Park, and we had North Point Lighthouse there, and it just fascinated me. And after working on the restoration of the lower range lights, I got hooked on lighthouses.
And what got you into appearing not just as a volunteer at lighthouses, but in character as a lighthouse keeper? Two different lighthouse keepers, actually.
Well, we had an event at the Ridges called the Ridges Natural Christmas in December of 2013, and we had people coming through on tours for the range light at that time, and I thought, wouldn't it be neat to appear in a uniform with a lighthouse service, have somebody appear as that. And in May of that year, before we had the Door County Lighthouse Festival, I got myself a reproduction of a United States Lighthouse Service uniform.
And you appeared at Bailey's Harbor as Henry Gaddy, I think, was the lighthouse keeper. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Well, Henry was an interesting fellow, and he was the last keeper at the Bailey's Harbor Range Lights. He served there for 27 years, as long as all the other keepers combined. And Henry was born in Belgium, and he came here as an eligible bachelor, and I guess that's what makes him kind of fascinating to play, because all the girls in Bailey's Harbor were after him because he had a good federal job, and he married Eve Henrich in 1901 and supposedly broke a lot of ladies' hearts at the time.
So all the women were disappointed when Henry got married?
They were, and it's rather interesting, too, because the other keeper I portray is William Duclan at the Eagle Bluff Lighthouse, and they had seven sons, and those sons had a band that they played in. And there's an article in the Door County Advocate Archives that said the Duclan Brothers Band played at Henry and Eve's wedding. They played well into the early morning hours, and people had such a good time, they wanted Henry and Eve to get married once a month.
So these, the lighthouse keepers, I would think of that as a really solitary position, isolated from people. It sounds like they were actually big parts of their communities.
They were at both Eagle Bluff and at the Bailey's Harbor Range Lights. They were close. Eagle Bluff was close to Fish Creek, and Ephraim and Bailey's Harbor was just north of the town. So they were very active social places, very much unlike a keeper that would have lived out on an island. People visited all the time.
What would daily life have been like for Henry Gaddy as far as what he was actually doing on the job?
What he was doing on the job, the primary requirement was that the lights had to be burning at all times at night. And when Henry was the keeper, they used kerosene as a fuel in the lamps. Range lights come in pairs. It's actually like taking care of two lighthouses. So kerosene would burn about 6 hours a fill, so he had to keep those lights lit all through the night. In the daytime, he had the lighthouse instructions. The keepers said that the lantern room windows and the Fresnel lens had to be clean and shining by 10 o'clock the following morning.
How important were these lighthouses for shipping in the Great Lakes back then? In this age of GPS, I think maybe we forget how hard it might have been to navigate.
Well, it was. At the time when the range lights were built, Bailey's Harbor was one of the major ports on Lake Michigan. Cana Island was the coastal lighthouse that got people into the area, and the range lights got ships safely into Bailey's Harbor, where they could get over to the piers. The first lighthouse that was built in Bailey's Harbor in 1852 was probably put in the wrong place, because as ships would approach it and come across, they would start hitting the sandbars and shoals, so it maybe caused more shipwrecks than it should have.
We're talking to Ed Miller about the lighthouses of Wisconsin. He's a volunteer at a couple of our lighthouses around the state, portrays some of the original lighthouse keepers. Ed, you were just talking some about the earlier history of the Bailey's Harbor range lights. Can you talk about when it shut down and then the restoration efforts that take us into the modern day?
Well, the Coast Guard decommissioned the lights in 1969. Roy Lucas was the first employee of the Ridges Sanctuary, where the lights, the Ridges Sanctuary are the caretakers of the Bailey's Harbor range lights. And Roy lived in the range light house, the upper light. He came home one day and found that the Coast Guard was there and decommissioned. They took the Fresnel lenses out. So after we restored the lower range light, he said, why can't we have them all the time? So we talked with the Coast Guard, and they said, sure you can. You can be a private aid to navigation. So we turned them on in June of last year, and they've been lit ever since. We're back on the lighthouse list in the navigation charts.
So this isn't just of historical interest. You're actually serving as a navigation point now.
We are. And people still tend to use those lighthouses to know where they are.
Now, what's the next step for restoration at the Bailey's Harbor range lights?
Well, the next step is the upper range light used to be the administrative offices for Ridges Sanctuary staff. The Ridges, we built a new nature center last year. Staff moved out of the range light, so now the range light is vacant. Actually, we have tours going on this year. We're at the beginning stages of a restoration process to actually take the range lights and furnish it back in the time when Henry Gaddy was the lighthouse keeper, around the turn of the century, late 1800s, early 1900.
So Henry, if I'm doing the math right, Henry, you said, started in the early 1900s. It was decommissioned in 1969. Was there a period where it was automated or mechanized?
Actually, it was automated. That's why Henry had, he was transferred to Cana Island when it was automated. They used acetylene gas to automate it. They had a device called the sun valve that would turn the lights on and off. It stayed with acetylene until about 1930 when the electricity went in, still automated. And what happened at that point is the Bailey's Harbor Lutheran Church rented the range light from the lighthouse service and used it as their parsonage. Their ministers and families lived there, three different families from 1930 to around 1955.
So they're trying to spread the light in more ways than one, I guess.
Well, they sure were, and actually they were probably one of the only ministers that were also lighthouse keepers, because if the bulbs burned out, they were responsible for changing the bulbs.
Now, if we go on a tour of the lighthouses that you work at, that you perform at, in a way, as lighthouse keepers, what kind of things can we see today?
Well, we'll talk about Eagle Bluff Lighthouse first. It's the only lighthouse on the mainland of Door County that is fully furnished. It's furnished as it was in the time when William Duclon, his wife Julia, and their seven sons lived there. The Bailey's Harbor Range Light were at the beginning stages of restoration. We have pictures on the wall of the history of that lighthouse, and people can climb up to the lantern room and look out the lantern room and see the great view down the boardwalk towards the lower range light and Lake Michigan out and beyond.
When you're not at Eagle Bluff or at the range lights, do you tour other lighthouses around the Great Lakes?
I spent so much time working on this. But there are a lot of other lighthouses that I would like to tour and see. I mean, I've seen Port Washington because it's on the way when I go down to Milwaukee every once in a while. And actually, we had a great tour with our preservation architect. She's working on the restoration of the Kewaunee Pierhead Light, and that was really fascinating.
So for people who haven't checked out any of these lighthouses, can you share your enthusiasm? Some make the case that, hey, these are worth checking out.
They are worth checking out. And actually, if people don't want to drive to them themselves, the Door County Trolley Company has lighthouse tours where you go to the Door County Trolley Station at Egg Harbor. They'll take you to Eagle Bluff Lighthouse. They come over to the range lights. They show people where the old Bailey's Harbor Birdcage Lighthouse is. They have lunch, and they go out to Cana Island Lighthouse. It's just a very pleasant way of spending a day, and there are times when I will be at either Eagle Bluff or the Bailey's Harbor Range Lights to greet them as the lighthouse keeper.
And when you are, as we wrap up, Ed, when you are one of the lighthouse keepers, what's one of the most common questions that people have for you?
Where did you get that uniform from?
Where did you get? I would have no idea where to get a lighthouse keeper's uniform.
Well, there's a place out in Massachusetts, Kenrick A. Claflin and Company, Lighthouse Antiquities. He has reproduction lighthouse uniforms, so I got the cap and the emblems from him, and the coat itself came from a uniform company in Indiana.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Ed, for spending time with us today.
Well, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Ed Miller. You could see pictures and get info about the Range Lights restoration effort. We have links on the Central Time Facebook page.
If you remember the book that inspired this scene, you might have high levels of empathy. Take a listen.
The defendant is not guilty. But somebody in this courtroom is. Now, gentlemen, in this country, our courts are the great levelers. In our courts, all men are created equal.
That was from the movie adaptation of the Harper Lee classic, To Kill a Mockingbird. According to a new study, people who read certain types of literary fiction, books by people like Harper Lee, Salman Rushdie, or Toni Morrison, are more likely to understand other people's feelings. In other words, they might demonstrate more empathy.
But not all fiction is the same. The study also says that genre writing from authors like Danielle Steele and Clive Cussler doesn't seem to have the same empathy effect on its readers.
Our next guest is one of the authors of the study. David Kidd is a Whiting Foundation postdoctoral fellow at the New School for Social Research's Psychology Department. David, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And also joining us to tell us more about literary fiction as a genre is Mark Rotella. He's a senior editor at Publishers Weekly and co-host of the weekly radio show PW Radio. Mark, welcome.
Thank you so much.
And David, I'm going to start with you. What did you set out to measure with your new study?
Great question. What we tried to do in this study was to get a sense of people's reading habits. So we did not conduct an experiment in which we randomly assigned people to read different types of fiction. Instead, we just asked them to complete a measure that gave us a sense of what type of fiction do they read. And we also had them complete a test of social perception, in which they're asked to to identify the complex emotional states of other people. And what we wanted to know was whether or not different types of reading habits differently predicted performance on this social perception test. And what we found was that the more authors that we categorized as more literary, a person recognized, the better they performed on this test. And as you just said, we did not find the same thing for the more popular genre fiction writers, so the more formulaic works.
What makes you decide that those two things are related, the literary work that someone reads and their degree of empathy? Couldn't be another quality that's coming into play?
Certainly. And, you know, I should just say that any study like this is going to not be able to capture everything. So, you know, all of our interpretations are a bit tentative, but we still think they're meaningful. But the reason that we were really interested in this distinction between more literary fiction and more formulaic genre fiction was that from a psychological perspective, we know that when we perceive other people, we tend to do so in a very efficient, quick manner that relies a lot on just knowledge of how the social world works, so knowledge of how people are expected to behave in certain situations. And we also use stereotypes. And not all of the time are these stereotypes the sort of prejudiced stereotypes we associate with really negative impacts on people. But it's a stereotype to think that, for example, a social psychologist might know more about social psychology than, say, a biologist, right? That's a stereotype. One hopes it's true. But you're making your judgment on the basis of information you already have or you already think you have about the other person, rather than engaging in what psychologists call individuation, in which you build up a perception of the person really from the ground up. And we think that literary fiction, because it's often more focused on character development, has fewer stock characters in general, we think that reading literary fiction is more likely to train this sort of bottom-up perception of other people that really focuses on that person's unique mental states at the moment, rather than a general impression about a category of people.
And Mark, I want to bring you in on this. Does this surprise you that the reading of literary fiction, which maybe could be described in this case as character-based, might produce someone who's more empathic?
You know, it's funny. When I first read the piece, that came out in The Guardian about this, I talked to a few colleagues and a few friends, and they're like, yeah, of course that makes sense. And it is kind of interesting exactly what you know, David is saying. You know, with so much of literary fiction, it focuses on the human condition rather than, say, in much of genre fiction, I don't want to say all of it, where the focus is on moving the plot forward, where the character is the conflict arises in plot changes for the character, and the character reacts to that, rather than oftentimes in literary fiction, internal conflict and what happens there. So you do have, I think they mentioned, David mentioned something about the subtlety in perception on the part of the reader as to what is going on with any character, where it might be more obvious what is driving a character in genre fiction, maybe a thriller or a romance, rather than in literary fiction.
I mean, do you think it might also be true that the stories in literary fiction, if I think about some of the great novels in the last year, a lot of them have terribly sad or tragic plot points. Do you think that's part of it, too?
I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of the, at least the ones, if we're referring to the same ones, a lot of them have focus on family, or at least the last few years, a lot of, you know, a lot of what we call literary fiction focuses on family. So perhaps that there is some sort of darkness or a depressive matter that could be it. I mean, it could be that it's really kind of putting a lens on stuff that happens that we often don't like to talk about or admit to talking about.
We're talking right now with David Kidd and Mark Rotella, and David did a study looking at the effect maybe that reading literary fiction can have on people's empathy. They seem to be more empathic if they're readers of literary fiction. Mark Rotella with us now, and he's with Publishers Weekly, looking at what it is about literature that could be responsible for this. And David, I mean, I'm sure people have asked you this question already, but is this possibly prescriptive? If you have a person that would like to develop greater empathy, could they just, pick up some Dostoevsky or some Toni Morrison?
I would, as a reader, I would love to be able to say yes, absolutely. I don't think that, this line of research really is still in its infancy. And I think that we still need to gather more evidence. But I think also that when it comes to deciding whether or not we should encourage people to read and to read fiction that will challenge their thinking or maybe draw them into these sometimes darker places, as Mark was mentioning, where we really reflect on other people and perhaps ourselves, I think we don't have to just look to psychological studies. I mean, teachers, ordinary readers, have long been saying that fiction matters a lot to them and that they feel that it makes them more attuned to themselves and others. And really that was a large basis for this work, was trying to, approach this sort of anecdotal, so it's a lot of anecdotes, this anecdotal evidence from a more systematic scientific perspective. But again, this scientific approach is new, and I don't think that the value of literature should hinge on a few studies at this point, certainly. And I also want to emphasize that myself and my colleague, Emanuele Castano, who's my co-author, neither of us believe that the results that we've found suggest that, first of all, that increasing interpersonal understanding is the most important thing about reading fiction, nor do we think that genre fiction cannot also have benefits to people.
And Mark, I want to see what you think, coming at this not as a scientist, but as a guy who loves books and talks about books and writes about books. What do you think it is about literature that makes people feel maybe more deeply for other people? What qualities are there? If you can point to a specific book, maybe.
I'm trying to think. I've read of the ones that I've read recently. I'm nearly finished with Colson Whitehead's The Underground Railroad, and here you have conflict, main characters making decisions that we could see ourselves making, perhaps, were we in the same situation or not. And that's the other thing, is we couldn't even imagine being in that situation. But that's one place there where you're following the main character woman, Cora, throughout the novel to see what decisions she makes. Both promoted by the plot, but also for herself. I mean, there's some really dark stuff going on, and that's one right there. I just finished reading Delia Ephron's Syracusa, which is another thing. Two couples on vacation in Syracuse, Sicily, and what happens when these four people, one with a child, five people get together, and the conflicts that arise. I mean, it's told from several different points of view, and just seeing what happens when you put these people together, and how what decisions you make can change the course of events.
We're talking with David Kidd of the New School for Social Research's Psychology Department about a study he co-authored about how reading literary fiction seems to help us understand other people's emotions. And Mark Rotella is with us, too. He's senior editor of Publishers Weekly and co-host of the weekly radio show PW Radio.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a reader of what you consider literary fiction? And do you think books by people like Harper Lee, Salman Rushdie, Toni Morrison, and others have helped you understand other people's emotions, understand other people, period? Do you read more genre fiction? What do you get out of that? In general, has reading made you a better person? And if you want a prescription for a book, you won't get that. But if you want a suggestion for some literary fiction, we could probably help you out. 800-642-1234 is the number, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing the conversation about how a new study shows that literary fiction may be able to help you understand other people's emotions. Talking now with David Kidd from New School and Mark Rotella from Publishers Weekly.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us if you think reading certain types of books helps create this sense of empathy, of understanding of others, non-fictional people in your life. Call in at 800-642-1234. And if you're looking for a book suggestion, Mark might be able to help you out. Again, 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll take our first caller now. We've got Mary with us in Appleton. Mary, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to share?
Well, I just find that reading fiction helps me identify my own feelings and my own personal awareness, which I think helps me with other people because I can maybe articulate a little bit better. I'm maybe not quite so self-aware as other people, so those descriptions and word pictures and ideas help me put myself into thought so I can contribute more to relationships and conversations.
That's a great point, Mary. And Mark, she's getting at their fiction as a tool for self-understanding, not even understanding other people, but maybe yourself first. Do you think that's something that happens a lot when we read literature?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, and that's been throughout history, some of the greatest literature. And by literary, I don't necessarily mean, you know, not popular fiction. I mean, we've had great popular fiction like Dickens, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, much of which was serialized and read by the masses. But they, too, just kind of dealt with the human condition. I mean, there's I should ask the caller what kinds of books has she read?
Well, I guess I'm probably more of a fantasy science fiction. I have been working my way through a lot of the classics, and I can't say always the entire book helps me understand myself, but there's just going to be a snippet or a character identification or description that gives me a light bulb moment that go, oh, that's me.
Right. Thank you so much, Mary. So Mary's saying she has these moments of self-identification. Sometimes hearing someone else describe it helps us see it in ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And Mary, thank you for the call. And we're going to go next to Judy in Milwaukee. Judy, hi.
Hello. I was influenced by what books I was assigned to read in grade school, like Red Badge of Courage and To Kill a Mockingbird. And I was also influenced by the people in my family unit. I had two sisters with special needs and also some other relatives with special needs, and that drew me to the medical field. And I still prefer that type of genre today where I can learn and be empathetic, and that's what I have to say.
Judy, thank you so much for calling. And David, I want to ask you about some of the books we read when we're young. Do you think there's any evidence out there, you know, if you could extrapolate, that there might be something formative about reading, and reading in particular veins when we're young?
Yeah, there. I haven't done any of that research myself, but that's because other people got to it first. And there was a really interesting study done by a team, Peskin and Astington, and they specifically looked at very young children, so storybooks, so even earlier than, you know, Red Badge of Courage or To Kill a Mockingbird. And what they found was that when parents read storybooks to their children, those children ended up performing better on sort of more child-appropriate tests of empathic accuracy or theory of mind. And what was really interesting about their finding was that it was actually the books that had fewer emotion terms in them that seemed to have the biggest effect. And the reason for that, the psychologists posited, was that whenever the emotions were not explicitly stated for the child had to figure it out. And they often did so with the help of the person reading the book with them. So there would be a discussion of, well, why does this character feel this way? And that is what's thought to really help, especially in kids, develop this capacity to represent other people's emotions and thoughts.
That's interesting, Mark, because isn't that one of the hallmarks of good writing is showing, not telling, and then having a discussion? You know, you're not saying Joey was sad. You're showing that he's sad.
You know, I was just going to say that I also teach creative writing, and you know, the whole idea of showing, not telling, where, you know, we don't say so-and-so said coldly. It's communicated in the words, and it's kind of, and again, talking about subtle references, and you perceive it somewhat differently, and I imagine this is what David's talking about, rather than she turned boldly and said something, you know, and said, step out of my way. Rather, she turned, step out of my way, and letting the dialogue speak for itself, but also having nuances there that you're over time you start picking up on in the subtlety of the writing and of people's, you know, in the subtlety of people in general, their own decisions and their own reactions to things.
And Mark, while we've got you on the line, I want to ask you, you know, David has told us this isn't a prescription that you can take, read a book and you'll be more empathic, but if it were, what would you recommend that we read if we really want to dive and walk in someone else's shoes and feel what they're feeling and maybe learn about ourselves? What do you recommend that's out there right now?
Well, I'd mentioned the Colson Whitehead's book, which is just a fantastic book. Swing Time by Zadie Smith is another one about the, you know, two girls who dream of being dancers. Louisa Ermolino, who's our senior, or who's our reviews director, has a book called Malafemina, and she talks about this collection of short stories, mostly on strong-willed women. We've got Richard Russo, who just came out with a book called Everybody's Fool, and I'm just looking down the list of a couple of things that I had wanted to mention. Ann Patchett, Commonwealth. Ann Patchett's another one who's a collage of parents, children, and stepchildren. Again, another family narrative. So those are a couple that have been kind of popping up in my mind, including The Knicks by Nathan Hill, is a novelist who's just been getting a lot of attention. And this is about a son and a mother who left him as a child, and the son's search for meaning and the void that she left. I mean, there's just been a lot of really good stuff coming out. I hope I'm not talking too fast. I hope that anyone out there might be able to write pretty quickly.
Right. A lot of good suggestions, though. That Ann Patchett one just landed on my desk this week, and I love her writing. But thank you for giving us some suggestions. And David and Mark, thank you both for joining us today.
It was great to be with you. Thank you.
Oh, thanks for having me.
That was David Kidd, researcher and PhD candidate in the psychology department at the New School for Social Research. And Mark Rotella joined us. He's the senior editor at Publishers Weekly and co-host of the weekly radio show PW Radio.